So I want to read, first of all, a passage briefly which expresses some of this aspect and a few other of it from Almansetter's Luck, where the minister, who is one of the major characters in the novel, is in a garden thinking about a sermon which he's going to preach, which is really going to destroy Almansetter, a member of the community. He's really going to wrap up people and so on. And he is considering this power which he possesses. And it expresses, I think, mainly this passage, two of the functions, namely those of self-expression and also those of manipulation, that is power, that are possible. Like a schoolboy released to his summer, he capered in the garden. He knew how the orator, the actor, felt, what they sought in their success. He could tickle them, and they would laugh. He could spank them, and they'd howl. He could caress, and sighing, they'd respond. He was an honest preacher at last. Through this thicket now, he could thrust his stick to stir the soul. It was better, he felt, touching them this way than all the ways he had imagined would bring on rapture if he had only dared to reach out to employ them, boldly to stare or boldly speak, harshly to grasp and greedily to seize. That knee, for instance, for which he'd known such bitter regret, he might have moistened with his lips while his delicately socketed accompanist pretended that his passion was merely pity for her suffering and gently tangled her hands in his hair. How he might have made an altar, how he might have worshipped there. Or the crisp green girl who'd called one day, like an eminent Cleveland lady, to carry on such a sweet and holy conversation with him, he felt licked clean and wished gratefully to embrace her. Or all those times, his nose in the weeds, he had lain at the fence watching the croquet, unable to ask if he might play. Or for Fatty Ruth, or the plump girl on the train whom only his shadow had petted, or any of a thousand simple impulses that hurled themselves helplessly against the walls of his heart, to finger the lobe of a strange ear, or sniff on hands and knees a patch of something wet, make body verses up and sing them loudly, leap in the air, chew on the thumb of a leather glove, play soccer in the street, any sudden gesture of joy or love. But who could know, when he heard his heart, what the beating was? And who could be expected to understand these gestures, so out of character, so threatening? For weren't they the same moves that went with rage, with lust, with any molesting? Well, no matter. It was all a dream, this rapture of touch. You'd taste the knee's rough cover with your tongue. The little girl would squeak and click her eyes. Your sweetheart would wet on your hand. Yes, words were superior. They maintained a superior control. They touched without your touching. They were at once the bait, the hook, the line, the pole, and the water in between. Now, in this passage, I think that the character is musing about two functions, then, that the artist may use his language for, and one of the reasons why he uses language. First, then, to, in this sense, express yourself. Now, in this kind of passage, and in other kinds of passages, I think we find a character who is, in a sense, bottled up and kept in. What I want to talk about particularly is the kind of emotion, I suppose, which I manipulate in this way more than I, at least, judge any other, and that, as I mentioned earlier, resentment. Indeed, when I began to look at passages to illustrate this, it was hard for me to find one that didn't. So it would seem to me that in many ways, from this point of view, resentment, the kind of a passive emotion, indeed, that Nietzsche's talking about, is the major stimulus. What happens, of course, is the displacement of a response from a normal, say, situation in which it would be appropriate. Somebody insults you, and you wait until several days later to insult somebody else in response or get angry and so on. It is indeed what Nietzsche called fundamentally as a passive emotion. But you don't merely express that resentment. What you do is try to formalize it, and then it becomes a way, I think, of transforming the feeling. In short, it's a coward's way, I suppose, of expressing hatred or dislike, but it's also a way of expressing love because you go to the trouble of making it over. Now, I want to quote a passage in which this occurs, I think, from an essay in which, and I'm certainly not quoting this as an example of how one ought to write, this passage is indeed hurt by two things. First, the resentment that motivates it, and secondly, by the triteness of the sentiments expressed. This occurs in an essay which is about popular culture and was designed to be given to an audience of popular culturists and folklorists, etc. And it's pretty clear that I was not out to be popular and didn't indeed. In fact, I had to retreat behind the chairs or I would have been assaulted. What one sees in a passage like this, I think, is I'm talking about people in general and see that that's really not the case. Must we be drunk or doped or mad? Must we be dunced and numb to feed our animal halves? So it appears. The average man does not want to know how he looks when he eats. He defecates in darkness, reading the Reader's Digest. His love has an awkward, automatic metal brevity, like something sprayed from a can, and any day his present sex may be replaced with plastic. His work is futile, his thought is shallow, his joy is ephemeral, his howls helpless and agony incompetent. His hopes are purchased, his voice pre-recorded, his play is mechanical, the roles tight, their lines trite. All strengths are sapped, exertion anyhow is useless, to vote or not is futile, futile. So in almost every way, he is separated from the centers of all power and feeling. Futilely he feeds, he voids, he screws, he smokes, he motorboats, he squats before the tube. He spends at least a week each year in touring and a month in memorizing lies. Lies moral, religious, and political. He beats the drum or shouts hooray on cue. He wears a neon nightie, swallows pills, and chews his women's nipples now because a book he's read has told him that he ought to. My God, he jigs, he swigs, he sings the very latest tra-la-las and sends his kids to scouts and all-white schools. He rounds his bottom to a pew, loves pulpitry, and contributes yearly to a cause. With splendid sexlessness he breeds, boards receive their nails with greater sensitivity. He kites the lies he's learned as high as heaven where they sing like toads in trees, yet he sickens just the same and without reason, for he's been to bridge and bingo, said his raws as well as anyone, never borrowed on his insurance, kept his car clean, and put his three sons twice through Yale. But age, which is not real, hangs like a dirty shirt inside his freshly pressed tuxedo. Thus he fails, assumes another slumber, and dies like merchandise gone out of season. Imagine for a moment what would happen if the television paled, the radio fell silent, the press did not release. Imagine all the clubs and courses closed, magazines unmailed, guitars unplugged, pools, rinks, gyms, courts, stadia shut up. Suppose that publishers were to issue no more Dick, Prick, and Booby books. Movies were banned along with gambling, liquor, and narcotics, and men were suddenly and irrevocably alone with themselves. Alone only with love to be made, thought, sense, and dreadful life. What would be the state of our nature then, Mr. Hobbes? Well, now the giveaway, I suppose, of a passage is like this comes a few paragraphs later, when I conclude by saying none of these complaints is new, indeed not. And there would be little point in repeating them, except that from time to time one senses an effort to Hitlerize the culture of the folk. make it somehow spring from some deep well of human feeling, as if art were ever the triumph of sincerity over ineptitude, as if passion were a substitute for skill, as if indeed its gaucheries were not only charming, but aesthetically so. This, in order to put out those high and isolated fires, those lonely works of genius which still manage somehow amazingly now and then to appear. There is no folk, of course. There are no traditions. Fine moral sentiments improve no lyrics nor beautify their song. The occasional appearance of splendid exceptions does not soften, excuse, or justify anything. Popular culture is the product of an industrial machine which makes baubles to amuse the savages while missionaries steal their souls and merchants steal their money. How romantically he talks about it, you may say. What wretched little dramas he's made up. These wee morality plays from wild exaggerations, high and isolated fires, indeed. Anything which surrounds us like the air we breathe, with which, like wives and husbands, we're easy and familiar, can't be so poisonous. We are alive, aren't we? Well, no, if you ask me, we aren't, or only partially. This muck cripples consciousness. Therefore, no concession should be made to it, and those who take their pleasure there should not be permitted to appear to lift those tastes to something higher with scholarly hypocrisy and philosophical pretense. The objects of popular culture are not art. Their success or failure should not be judged as art's is, and the pleasures they provide among goods come last, even if, as Plato says, they are asserted to be first by all the oxen in the world. And so I went home and kicked things in my crib and threw my rattle in the corner and so on and so forth. And that's the kind of thing I suppose I have in mind, at least by talking about it, even in a context of an essay, so to speak. Now that's one type then. The other type I want to talk about next is what comes under, and I only briefly, persuasion, the problems of persuasion, or rhetoric. Here, you're not so much concerned to express yourself in such a way that however it is expressed, people will accept it, in which the emphasis then is changing the feelings so that they will be acceptable. Here, the aim is to change the listener. The rhetorician operates on the audience, and what his study concerns is fundamentally the relationship between language and the listener, not so much the language and himself, which is the problem for the expression person. This, of course, is the kind of thing we find all the time in preaching and in teaching, I suppose, and politics and advertising. To the degree the novel that I wrote was about a preacher, was much concerned with concepts of rhetoric in the sense of the manipulation of the audience by language. Here, of course, the art of the sophist is the most important art. But the shift, steady shift, in which the medium itself and the task to be performed begins to change what you were originally up to, the same kind of molding the message occurs here as well as in the expression contexts. And in both cases, what you have initially is the withdrawal of the speaker and the manipulation of people with language to touch them that way, as the character here says, rather than to touch them directly. You substitute, in short, the manipulation of the audience. You substitute for that manipulation of the audience the manipulation of language. So you steadily back up, or tend to back up, from the initial projection to the manipulation of what in fact are, of course, symbols, substitutes, if you like, for reality, language itself. Finally, and the most important one, it seems to me, the only one motive which strikes me as having much to do with aesthetics, with art as such, is the manipulation of the medium for its own sake. Here, it's not your demands, nor those of your audience, that matter. For in this sense, as an artist, you don't have an audience. That's the wrong way, I think, to think about it. Someone may indeed read or see what you do, but what you are fundamentally faced with is the word, and it is no longer a substitute for the things in the world. It becomes the world, as Yeats wrote, "Words alone are certain good." And although, of course, with the manipulation of words, you don't have the power you might like to have, you're severely limited, and as soon as you try to start maneuvering words around, you find how limited you are. Nevertheless, much more satisfactory way of managing things than trying to manipulate the world around. The first thing, of course, is the words are a whole lot lighter than sofas, and they don't respond to your mishandling of them, your cruelty toward them, and so on, the way human beings do. So consequently, while the words of the expression type may be embarrassing in their revelations, indeed as revealing as a belch, a sneeze, or an erection, nevertheless, they are merely symptoms of this inner condition. Words of the rhetorician, of course, also reveal something about the rhetorician's intentions, what he intends to prove, what he hopes to persuade you of, wants to gain a vote, sell a product, bend a mind in some direction. The constructions of the artist don't readily do so. And as a consequence, the pursuit of the author, to the degree he is an artist, will be all the harder. You will not be able as easily to find out what's happening or what's really going on behind his language. And people are very often confused, I think, about how the imagination works. Yet I think that's because simply they don't pay attention to their own. All you have to do is to remember how you last elaborated a tale, how you last falsified your little trip to the supermarket to make it more interesting. Now, there are those who lie in order, of course, to deceive you, alter or mislead your mind. Like the rhetorician who is starting out with the best intention in the world to tell you the truth and then gets hung up on the way he's going to tell it and so ends up altering what he meant to. There are other people who enhance themselves by the use of language, mislead in order to pretend that they're something other than they are, lie to themselves, in short. And then there's the poet who seems to lie merely because he's not concerned with messages and the truth at all. He's not lying because he's actually not making any assertions. Now, of course, I'm perfectly aware that many poets, writers in general, would not agree with this. And I'm saying only as poets, not as people who have noble truths to enunciate, but as poets, am I concerned under that category. A work of art is a construction. It is not an autobiography. The simple-minded things, then, constantly occurring, everybody makes them, I think, naturally enough, and then the warning against them, I think, will be obvious. I once wrote a story that took place in some nameless western place where there were lots of blizzards. And then people noticed that I was born in Fargo, North Dakota, and they said, "Aha! He has experienced the wild winds of the West, and he has set down the vast empty spaces." Blah, blah, blah. You know. It was disappointing, indeed, to the point of anger, for some people to discover that I left Fargo, North Dakota, in a wicker basket. I like to think something like Moses. When I was 6 weeks old. And although I got back there afterward, it was always in the summertime, and I didn't see the winter, so I saw some snow.